Turn to Isaiah chapter 42, and as you will recall, we have just begun the second section of the book of Isaiah, which began at chapter 40, and that second section runs from chapter 40 through 66. It is 27 chapters altogether, which divides into three sections of 9 chapters each. We've not gotten very far into the section up to this point. We've only covered the first two of those chapters. I hope to make up, if possible, for some lost time today. Part of the reason that I think we should be able to do that is because the subject matter of the chapters before us, at least on many occasions, will be a duplication or simply a further development of some subjects that have come up in the chapters we've just covered. Because in chapters 41, I would say, through 48, which is basically the first of the three sections of this part of Isaiah, those 9 chapters, that section covers a number of topics repeatedly. I shared with you in our last session what those topics are. One of the things that it comes up repeatedly is a denunciation of idols and a statement of how foolish it is to worship idols. In the present text that we'll be studying today, we have one of the more lengthy denunciations and ridiculing of idolaters that exist in the book of Isaiah. Another subject that comes up is the servant of Jehovah, which in the early stages of this discussion seems to refer to Israel most of the time. Already, we saw in chapter 41 and verse 8, "But thou, Israel, art my servant." And also in verse 9 of that chapter, that he said to Israel, "You are my servant, I have chosen thee and not cast thee away." The references to the servant of Jehovah are numerous in the following chapters. And it, as I said, a lot of the time it appears to be references to Israel. Though we have the remarkable phenomenon that some of the passages about the servant of Jehovah clearly refer to Christ. One of the most well-known of these is Isaiah 53. The whole chapter is clearly about Christ, and yet it's what is called one of the servant songs of Isaiah. That's what scholars tend to speak of these passages as. You realize that the prophets sometimes wrote in poetry form. It doesn't come out in our King James Version that much, especially if if the edition that we're reading doesn't set the type in poetic form. But if you have a newer translation, a lot of times you'll notice that the newer translations will set large sections of the prophetic chapters into, something other than ordinary paragraphs. And what they're doing is trying to identify for the reader the fact that that section that is offset in that way is written in poetic form. And so there are extensive poetic sections in the prophets, and in Isaiah particularly, and a number of these sections have this servant of Jehovah as their central theme. And scholars have come to call these the servant songs of Isaiah, the poetic sections about the servant. And we have one of those servant songs at the beginning of our chapter 42, which we'll begin with today, but we've had reference to the servant of Jehovah already in chapter 41, and we will continue to. And sometimes, and most of the time, apparently, it refers to Israel. But sometimes it refers to Christ. And I've already mentioned how those two ideas fit together. I'm sure that we'll bring it up again later. Another of the subjects that recurs is a reference to Cyrus, although he's mentioned by name only once or twice, and that in the chapters that I hope to cover today, chapters 44 and 45, mention Cyrus by name. There are other passages going all the way back to chapter 41 and verse 2, and then there's probably half a dozen or so passages like this in the following chapters that are talking about Cyrus. And I'll remind you, Cyrus was the Persian or Media-Persian ruler who is responsible for the conquering of Babylon. And that, of course, is significant just from the aspect of secular history, but because of what that did to the nation of Israel, it becomes significant for biblical history, and this is why Cyrus becomes the subject of discussion a number of times in Isaiah, because Isaiah at this point is discussing the punishment of the Jews that God would bring upon them by sending them into captivity in Babylon. But he looks beyond that 70-year captivity to the time of God delivering them from that, and since Cyrus was the human agent through whom this deliverance came, Cyrus is mentioned by name and then sometimes referred to not by name, but nonetheless in view. in a number of passages, and we will see references to him, including, like I said, one of the longest and most specific passages about Cyrus is also in the chapters that I hope to cover today. So we have passages that talk about idols, ridiculing idolaters. We have passages that talk about the servant of Jehovah. We have passages that talk about Cyrus. We also have passages where God states his superiority over the idols in that he can tell the future and they cannot. The first instance of this is in chapter 41, which we already saw, and verses 21 and following, where he challenged the idols to predict the future and thereby to demonstrate that they truly were gods. If they are commanding worship, let them show themselves to be worthy of worship. Let them show themselves to have a valid claim to worship by showing themselves to be gods. Now, of course, this is all rhetorical when he challenges them, because the idols and the gods of the heathen are unable to speak or answer or even hear the challenge. But the idea here is it's more of a rhetorical challenge for the sake of demonstrating to the reader that these idols can't even hear the challenge, much less answer it, and that to worship idols is a foolish thing. And the reason this comes up so many times in the passage before us is because the Babylonian captivity was brought upon the Jews largely because of idolatry. Now, they had other crimes against God that they were guilty of, including oppression of the poor and of widows and orphans. They failed to give the land its sabbatical years, which they should have given by law. There were a number of reasons that God drove them into Babylon, but one of the chief reasons had to do with their idolatry. And in a number of places, we learn that God is going to use this 70 years in Babylon to purge them of idolatry. And sure enough, historically, we see that happen. Though the Jews, from the time of Moses on until the Babylonian captivity, a period of several hundred years, probably 600 or 700 years at least, during that time, they were habitually going into idolatry. During the period of the judges, they were repeatedly going into idolatry. It was a chronic problem throughout the whole time of the monarchy and the divided monarchy. Just all the time, they were lapsing every generation or so into idolatry, and sometimes they went several generations in idolatry without turning back to Jehovah. It was a major problem in their history for hundreds of years. But after the Babylonian captivity, and since that time, there has never been idolatry practiced by the Jews, at least not in the blatant sense of carving statues and worshiping them. Of course, we could say there is idolatry in the sense of, you know, even modern Jews today, like many modern non-Jews, you know, worship money or some other thing. But as far as blatant, overt idolatry, it really was purged out of them through this thing. However, until this time, until the Babylonian captivity, idols were a problem. And so repeatedly, the prophet ridicules those who worship idols, and especially ridicules the idols themselves. Now, these four themes are repeatedly coming up, and we will see them through the passages that we're talking about here too. Now, chapter 42 begins with a lengthy passage about the coming of Christ. And I find it interesting because, for the most part, when you find messianic passages in the Scriptures, in the Old Testament, it is not always clear that there will be two comings of Christ. Now, that's something we know because of the New Testament. We know Jesus came once, and when he left, he said he was going to return. And so we know that there will be a second coming of Christ. In the Old Testament, whenever the Messiah was discussed, a passage would ordinarily either discuss his first coming or his second coming, or would sometimes mix the two together, but it would never be clear, as far as reading it before Jesus came the first time, it would never be clear which it was talking about, or even necessarily that there would be two comings. This is something that was not clear until after Jesus came the first time and made things a little bit more clear to us. But in this passage, it would appear to me that there is a clear prediction of the first coming of Christ, followed by the age of the church, and then ending with the second coming of Christ. And I'll tell you why. I'll read the passage first of all, and maybe you'll see why without my even pointing it out, but I will point it out. Beginning with chapter 42 and verse 1, "Behold my servant." Now, this is a servant song, and this is the second reference to the servant of Jehovah in the book of Isaiah. Already we've got a reference to Christ in a servant song, though most of the early ones talk about Israel. "Behold my servant whom I uphold, mine elect, in whom my soul delighteth. I have put my spirit upon him. He shall bring forth judgment unto the Gentiles. He shall not cry, nor lift up, nor cause his voice to be heard in the street. A bruised reed shall he not break, and the smoking flax shall he not quench. but shall bring forth judgment unto truth. He shall not fail nor be discouraged until he hath set judgment in the earth, and the isles shall wait for his law. Thus saith God, the Lord, he that created the heavens and stretched them out, he that spread forth the earth, and that which cometh out of it, he that giveth breath unto the people upon it, and spirit to them that walk therein. I, the Lord, have called thee in righteousness. I will hold thine hand. I will keep thee, and give thee for a covenant of the people, and for a light of the Gentiles, to open the blind eyes, to bring out the prisoners from the prison, and them that sit in darkness out of the prison house. I am the Lord, that is my name, and my glory will I not give to another, neither my praise to graven images. Behold, the former things are come to pass, and new things do I declare. Before they spring forth, I tell you of them. Sing unto the Lord a new song, and his praise from the end of the earth. Ye that go down to the sea, and all that is therein, the isles and the inhabitants thereof, let the wilderness and the cities thereof lift up their voice. The villages that Kedar doth inhabit, let the inhabitants of the rocks sing. Let them shout from the top of the mountains. Let them give glory to the Lord and declare his praise in the islands. The Lord shall go forth as a mighty man. He shall stir up jealousy like a man of war. He shall cry, yea, roar. He shall prevail against his enemies. I have long time held my peace. I have been still and refrained myself. Now will I cry like a travailing woman. I will destroy and devour at once. I will make waste mountains and hills and dry up all their herbs. And I will make the rivers islands and I will dry up their pools. And I will bring the blind by a way that they knew not. I will lead them in paths that they have not known. I will make darkness light before them and crooked things straight. These things will I do unto them and not forsake them. They shall be turned back, they shall be greatly ashamed that trust in graven images, that say to molten images, ye are our gods. Hear ye deaf, and look ye blind, that ye may see. Then he goes on and says, who is blind but my servant? And this seems to mean Israel, the servant. But we'll talk about the importance of that next section, verses 19 through 25, in a moment. Let's look at these first 18 verses, because I think that they, I think that we have here a picture of the first coming of Christ, followed by a description of the church age in which we now live, and then followed by the ultimate second coming. Now, as far as the first coming of Christ, there can be no doubt that the chapter opens with a discussion of that, because the passage that we have before us is quoted about Christ in Matthew chapter 12, verses 18 through 20. And I'll read it to you from Matthew as he quotes it. Maybe I should begin reading with verse 14. Matthew 12, 14 through 20. Then the Pharisees went out and held a council against him how they might destroy him. But when Jesus knew it, he withdrew himself from there, and great multitudes followed him, and he healed them all, and charged them that they should not make him known, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet, saying, behold my servant whom I have chosen, my beloved in whom my soul is well pleased. I will put my spirit upon him, and he shall show my judgment to the Gentiles. He shall not strive nor cry, neither shall any man hear his voice in the streets. A bruised reed shall he not break, and smoking flax shall he not quench, till he send forth judgment unto victory, and in his name shall the Gentiles trust. Now, that's obviously our passage here. And he says that it applies to Jesus, especially after the plots were laid to take his life by the Jewish leaders, that he withdrew into less public activity, and that he, when he did heal people, he asked them not to publicize it, because he was trying to keep a lower profile because of the threat to his life at that time. And therefore, it is said he didn't, you know, people didn't hear him crying in the streets and so forth. Now, there were times in Jesus' ministry where he did lift up his voice and cry out to the people. But what is being said here is there came a time when Jesus had to more or less maintain a low profile. And that is what Matthew says this prophecy was talking about. So we have the first four verses of Isaiah 42 cited for us in Matthew as a clear reference to Jesus at his first coming. Now let me look at these verses for a moment, then I'll show you what I consider to be the passage about his second coming. Behold my servant whom I behold. Now here we have the second reference to God, the Jehovah's servant. The last time we read about Jehovah's servant was chapter 41, verse 8, which says, but you, Israel, are my servant. And so no doubt Jews would tend to think of this present passage as continuing to talk about Israel as the servant of Jehovah. However, it became evident that the things that are said of the servant of Jehovah are not true of Israel. At least they never became true of Israel. Israel never did the things, for instance, what it says in verse 6, I, the Lord, have called thee in righteousness. I will hold thine hand, I will keep thee, and give thee for a covenant to the people and for a light to the Gentiles. Remember that God called Israel to be a light to the Gentiles, but they never were. And that's why Jesus called his disciples to be the light of the world, because the Jews had failed to do so. But what the Jews, what Israel as a nation failed to do, the man Jesus, who was a representative, and we might even say the representative Jew, did fulfill. It's as though we should realize that when God speaks to Israel, most of the time when he speaks favorably, he's really speaking to the faithful remnant. That's really what it gets down to. His words apply to the faithful remnant. And at one point in history, Jesus was the only faithful remnant when all his disciples forsook him and fled. And he was alone, standing faithful to God. I mean, his disciples had been part of the remnant, but even at one point, they even fled and deserted him. There was a point in time when Jesus alone was the faithful remnant of Israel. There was no one else faithful. And so it's quite applicable to say that if the servant of Jehovah is Israel, and by that meaning the faithful remnant of Israel, then those things that are said of the faithful remnant at one time in history applied only to Jesus, because he was all there was of the faithful remnant of Israel. And so it's quite appropriate to take these servant songs, which the Jews would tend to think of being about themselves, and to apply them really to Jesus. And in some cases, they only apply to Jesus, because there were no more Israelites that were faithfully doing these things. Now, an interesting thing, however, is that those that later became joined to Jesus, the growing faithful remnant after the cross, when the disciples returned and when, you know, other Jews came in and eventually Gentiles came in, this was the growing remnant, this is the growing spiritual Israel of whom these things are said. And so it's not surprising when it was said to the servant of Jehovah, I'll give you for a light to the Gentiles, that Jesus would say that this is fulfilled in him. As long as I am in the world, he said, I am the light of the world. But then he said to his disciples, you are the light of the world, implying that they are part of the remnant also that this applies to. But we have to just recognize this phenomenon in the book of Isaiah. What God intended for Israel to be, Israel never became as a whole nation. But Jesus did. And Jesus, you know, sometimes he's the only one to whom these statements can apply. And that is certainly the case in the present passage. Behold my servant, whom I uphold, mine elect, in whom my soul delighteth. Now, in saying mine elect, that means my chosen. Of course, the Israelites would think of this as being themselves, the chosen people, the elect race. However, the statement, in whom my soul delighteth, this statement is echoed in the voice from heaven that came when Jesus was baptized in the River Jordan, where God said, this is my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased, which is basically the equivalent of, in whom my soul delighteth. It is believed that the voice from heaven was restating this actual verse, in a sense, about Jesus, as well as a verse in Psalm 2, where God said to him, you are my son, this day have I begotten thee. But the voice from heaven took parts of two different verses, this being one of them, and put them together to pronounce his pleasure upon Jesus when he was baptized. I have put my spirit upon him. That happened when Jesus was baptized too. The spirit came down upon him in the form of a dove. And shall bring forth judgment, or we could substitute the word justice, to the Gentiles. Now, justice and judgment, of course, we could understand to be righteousness, and we could almost equate that with salvation, bringing salvation to the Gentiles, though I think there's more to it than that. It's obvious that God, throughout the book of Isaiah, is said to be looking for justice and righteousness in the way that people conduct themselves. And I believe in saying that Jesus will bring forth justice to the Gentiles, it speaks not only of the fact that he will bring salvation outside the walls of the Israelite community to Gentile people, but he'll also bring about a characteristic change in their behavior so that they begin to live righteous or just lives. Now, to say that this means that he will transform the whole Gentile world, as, say, the Reconstructionists or the postmillennialists believe will happen, is perhaps taking the verse too far. To suggest that all the nations of the world will become governed by the justice of Christ sometime prior to his second coming, I don't know that we could make such a statement at all from this verse. But to say that his justice, which is not only his imputed righteousness, but also the change in behavior that comes to a person when they align themselves under the teachings of Christ so that they begin to live justly, that is going to be given to the Gentiles through him, not only to the Jews. He shall not cry, nor lift up, nor cause his voice to be heard in the street. Now that, of course, was quoted in Matthew as being a reference to Jesus withdrawing into seclusion because of the threat to his life and limb from the Jewish authorities. Verse 3 says, a bruised reed shall he not break, And the smoking flax shall he not quench, and he shall bring forth judgment unto truth. He shall not fail or be discouraged until he hath set judgment in the earth, and the island shall wait for his law. Now, the statement about breaking a bruised reed or quenching a smoking flax, you may not be familiar, but a flax, it actually refers to the wick of a candle or of a lamp. They would have these oil lamps with a floating wick, and the wick was made out of flax. And in speaking of a smoldering wick, it's sort of a parallel to a bruised reed. In other words, that which is about had it. That which is a wick where the fire has been blown out, as it were, and there's nothing but a little spiral of smoke coming off the wick that's been extinguished. But it's not completely extinguished. There's at least some smoke still. Or the reed, it's been broken. You might as well just write it off. It's going to die. Or it's had its day. You can't repair it. A wick that's gone out and it is just smoldering, you can't really fan it back into a flame. It's talking about hopeless situations, that when he sees them, he won't finish them off. He won't quench it. He won't snuff out that wick. If there's any fire left in it all, if there's even smoke, if the reed is still standing, albeit it's broken, yet he won't bruise it. He won't destroy it. Rather, of course, we know he would miraculously restore it to life. He would heal that which was broken. The idea here is that Jesus, it's mainly a statement of the gentleness of his manner, that he would deal so gently that which was, speaking of people's spiritual condition, those who were, whose light had basically gone out, those who were like a bruised reed, who were being trampled upon by the religious leaders of the time, Jesus would not trample upon them. He would deal gently with such persons. He's not a destructive kind of person. There are certain personality types where, you know, if they see something that's damaged, they just take pleasure in finishing it off. I suppose if it's an injured animal, that's probably a good thing to finish them off for their sake. But there's just a destructive bent in certain kinds of people, maybe in all of us, that if we see something that's partially broken, it's kind of fun to just totally wipe it out. And Jesus was not that way. He didn't. If he saw something broken, rather than finish it off, he would seek to restore it. And he dealt gently with fragile people, is really what this is talking about. It says, he shall not fail or be discouraged till he has set judgment in the earth, and the island shall await his law, suggests that the influence of his ministry and of the justice that he will establish among the Gentiles will be global. Even the islands of the sea will come to receive his law. Now, again, that doesn't mean that as a whole, the national, governmental powers of those nations will accept his law and be governed by it, but rather that his law will reach every nation and lives will be changed in every place. As Jesus said, this gospel of the kingdom must be preached to every nation. And before the end comes, this is simply saying that that will happen. The church will not be snuffed out. The church will not fail. Jesus will not fail in this kingdom he's established. He won't even be discouraged. We get discouraged sometimes when we see temporary setbacks. And if we look at the state of the church today, there might be a sense in which we would tend to be discouraged. But God, to him, a day is like 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is as a day. We get discouraged if we don't see it all happening, in a few months or a few years' time, or even in our lifetime. But our lifetime is like a vapor to God, and he doesn't get discouraged just because a few generations pass without apparent progress. He won't get discouraged. He knows he's not going to fail. He's not worried about the situation, because his purposes will be fulfilled ultimately. And so we have here a picture of Jesus coming and of his ultimate success in bringing his righteousness and his rule to every corner of the earth, and that nothing will stop him, even though he's not militarily aggressive. He's not a violent kind of a person. He's not the kind of person who forces his way in the physical sense. He's not self-assertive. He's gentle. He doesn't break a bruised reed. He won't quench a smoking flax. He's meek, not the kind of person you would think would inherit the earth. And yet, the Bible says the meek shall inherit the earth, and Jesus himself said so. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. His very meekness and gentleness are the things that would make it seem like his law would never get outside of Palestine. There's too many hostile powers with armies to resist it. But it's the meekness of him that actually wins the nations, that actually wins over people from every nation. And his submission to the will of God, and even unto death, is what really was the show of his strength. And that is, it's on the basis of this of these higher principles of conquest, that he penetrates every culture without armies, but with simply the preached word and the willingness on the part of his disciples to do what he has done, to lay down their lives, to be meek and gentle, so that we find a summary of the church age in Revelation 12:11, saying that the devil has come down to afflict the people of God, the brethren that he has been accusing in it, but it says they overcame him by the blood of the Lamb and by the word of their testimony, and they loved not their lives unto the death. They overcame Satan by laying down their lives, not by fighting for their lives, but by not loving their lives, by considering themselves expendable. And when we think of cases like Jim Elliot and his companions who just laid down their lives, they made themselves totally vulnerable, and they just died. They were murdered for their effort to win the Aucas. You know, people could say, well, what a waste. But it was no waste, because it was largely the upshot from that very martyrdom that caused not only the Aucas to be reached and converted, but over, I forget what the number was, it was well over 1,000 missionaries, well over 1,000 college students immediately applied to mission boards to go on the mission field immediately after Jim Elliot and his companions were killed, just because their story inspired so many others to want to go out and lay down their lives. I mean, so it's the path of dying to yourself, not loving your life unto the death, and making yourself expendable for the kingdom of God, not being forcible in the way that the world takes nations with armies, but rather by laying down your life, you actually penetrate and conquer the powers of Satan. That's how Jesus did it, and how it's indicated in the scripture his followers will carry out his work. Now, where I said there's a reference to the second coming of Christ, I believe that begins at verse 13. And when we consider what verses 5 through 12 say, it's a logical place to begin the second coming of Christ, because I think in verses 5 through 12, we have a description of the church age, and I'll talk about that in a moment, but first let me show you what it says at verse 13 and following. The Lord shall go forth as a mighty man. He shall stir up jealousy like a man of war. That certainly is the way the book of Revelation describes Jesus at his second coming. He comes with a sharp sword. He's on a white horse with armies who are on white horses. With a sharp sword, he smites the nations. And it says specifically, he shall cry, yea, roar. He shall prevail against his enemies. That sounds like Revelation chapter 19 and verse 15, where Jesus comes on the white horse. But interestingly, it says he shall cry. In contrast with verse 2, he shall not cry, nor lift up his voice. This is why I think there's a clear reference here to two comings of Christ. At his first coming, he is seen not crying, not roaring like a lion, not pushing himself, not making a big splash publicly, you know, basically going into seclusion when resistance gets heavy, and you know, not defeating his enemies by some kind of a direct assault on them. He rather withdraws meekly and doesn't cry out. But at his second coming, he comes like a roaring lion. He comes crying, and not only crying, but roaring, he says. And so it seems to be setting a deliberate contrast between Christ's first coming and his second coming. And certainly, verse 13 does sound like the second coming of Christ. And when you go on to verse 14 and following, it's not surprising. Verse 14 says, this is an oracle. Jesus is actually speaking at the time of his second coming. He says, I have long time held my peace. I have been still and refrained myself, but now I will cry like a travailing woman. I will destroy and devour at once. I will make waste the mountains and hills. I will dry up all their herbs, and I will make the rivers islands. I will dry up the pools. Now this, in contrast with statements like those in the previous chapter, verse 17. Chapter 41, verse 17 says, when the poor and needy seek water, there is none, and their tongue faileth for thirst, I, the Lord, will hear them. I, the God of Israel, will not forsake them. I will open rivers in the high places and fountains in the midst of valleys. I will make the wilderness a pool of water and the dry land springs of water. I will plant in the wilderness the cedar and so forth. Now, I've talked about passages like that and said I believe that refers to the blessings of the new covenant in the spiritual life of the believer. But at his second coming, rather than making the wilderness into pools, he says in verse 15 he's going to dry up the pools. I'll dry up all the herbs on the mountains. Instead of making the... He's not talking about blessing at this point. He's talking about destruction and judgment, which is what takes place at his second coming. I'll dry up the pools. I will dry up the herbs on the mountains. I will make the rivers islands. Just the opposite of the language he uses of blessing in other places, he now uses language of judgment, which kind of is just seen to be the reverse of the other language. But here he's, in verse 14, says, I have a long time held my peace. We wonder sometimes how God can tolerate the wickedness in the world any longer. When we see abuses of children and of helpless people, and we say, why doesn't Jesus just come back and judge? Well, there's a sense in which I think he kind of is restraining himself. He's holding his peace. At his second coming, he says, I'm tired of holding my peace. Now I'm going to come and I'm going to destroy and devour. But in the meantime, he's waiting. He's holding his peace. He's been still and refraining himself. It says in verse 14, I've been still and refrained myself. Meaning, during the church age, between the first and second coming of Christ, he's been refraining himself from coming to judge. Because, why? Because it says in 2 Peter chapter 3, he's long-suffering, not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. That is to say, he could come now and destroy all sinners. The trouble is, some of those sinners, if he came now, would be destroyed, who might otherwise be saved if he waits a little longer. And that's what it's saying. If you consider 2 Peter chapter 3, it says in verses 8 and, well, verse 9, really, 2 Peter 3, 9, the Lord is not slack concerning his promise, as some men would accuse him of slackness, but is long-suffering, that is, patient toward us, not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. Now, this is the response to the mockers, who say in verse 2, where is the promise of his coming? Or verse 4, where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they were from the beginning of creation. Peter says in 2 Peter 3, 4, that mockers will come in last week and say, well, where is his coming? I thought some things were supposed to happen. I thought Jesus was supposed to come back. Where is it? Nothing's happened. Everything's the same as it's been for centuries. And he says, listen, don't think that he's slack. Don't think that he's unable to fulfill his threats, as some people might accuse him of. The real reason that he hasn't come yet is because he's not willing for people to perish. And he's waiting for everyone to come to repentance. Not that everyone will, but rather he's waiting for more to do so. If he would have brought his judgment 10 years ago, where would any of you be? You know? It's good that he tarried that long. And if he tarries another 10 years, who knows how many millions may be repented by then who have not yet. So this is why he's holding his peace. This is why he's refraining himself at this present time. But there will be an end of patience at some point. And this is his sentiments here in verses 13 through 15. He talks about he's coming. He's crying now. He didn't cry at his first coming, but he's crying out, yea, roaring now. He's coming to destroy and devour, like a lion to devour prey. He's going to lay waste the mountains. He's been holding his peace long enough. He's been refraining himself. He can't wait any longer. And then it says, although it makes all these threats of judgment in these verses, yet in verse 16, he says, and I will bring the blind by a way that they knew not. I will lead them in paths that they have not known. I will make darkness light before them, and crooked things straight. These things will I do to them and not forsake them. In other words, when he comes in judgment, it's going to be devastating, but not wholesale. That is to say, there will be some that he spares. There will be some that he's merciful to. The blind, those who are helpless, those presumably meaning those who were humble and righteous and so forth, rather than the wicked rulers. He kind of identifies the ones who were handicapped and so forth as being among those that are his. That wouldn't mean that simply being blind makes a person saved, but rather the weak, the downtrodden, the humble, those are the ones that have more to look forward to when he comes back than those who are wicked. But in contrast to them, in verse 17 says, they shall be turned back, they shall be greatly ashamed that trust in graven images, that say unto the molten images, you are our gods, hear ye deaf, and look ye blind, that ye may see. That is, the people say to their idols, you are gods, you blind, meaning the idols are blind, the idols are deaf, and yet the people say, look, hear, you know, but they can't hear, and they can't see. So he's saying when he returns, he'll bring great destruction upon those who have worshipped other gods, but there will be some who will find his preservation through it all. Now, if you can agree that verses 1 through 4 talk about the first coming of Christ, and we can hardly disagree since Matthew says that's the case, and that chapter and verses 13 and following then talk about his second coming, it should not surprise us to find a description of the intervening period in verses 5 through 12. And what we will see as we read these verses again
is that it describes the gospel age. That is, the present time between the first and second coming of Christ, where the gospel is being preached and the missionary effort is going out to all the parts of the earth. Verse 5, basically God identifies himself as the creator of the heavens and also the one who gives life and breath to all men, which by introducing this paragraph this way is to suggest there's nothing too hard for him. The things he declares that he's going to do, we can pretty much count on them happening. He's not going to fail or be discouraged. I mean, this is the God who made the heavens. This is the God that made the earth. This is the God that put breath into the first man's nostrils and continues to give breath to every living being today who could withdraw it in a moment. By the way, remember when Belshazzar, the king of Babylon, toasted the gods of the heathen using the holy vessels taken from the temple in Jerusalem, and he blasphemed God. Daniel said to him, you've honored the gods of wood and stone and false gods, but he says, the God in whose hand is your breath you have not honored. Meaning, Jehovah is the one who holds your breath in his hand, suggesting that if he wishes, he cannot give you the next breath. And certainly, since breathing is one of those functions of the body that we call an involuntary action, every man is at God's mercy to give him the next one. And he sees the irony of honoring all the gods that have no power, and yet failing to honor the God or to fear the God that holds your breath in his hand. Well, if God is the one who is the source of our breath, that is, of our continuing life, in fact, he's the source of the universe, then what he says here is going to happen is fairly sure going to happen. I mean, what's going to stop him? A God that big, a God who has created all things. Verse 6 says, I, the Lord, have called thee, this is his servant, but I understand this now, to be fulfilled through Christ, or by Christ through his church. I have called thee in righteousness, I will hold thy hand, I will keep thee and give thee for a covenant to the people, for a light to the Gentiles. Again, Jesus said, while I'm in the world, I'm the light of the world, but he's no longer in the world physically, so we are now the light of the world, the church. And what is the church to do? To open the blind eyes, to bring out the prisoners from the prison, and them that sit in darkness out of the prison house. This is basically a summarization of the whole missionary task of the church. To open people's eyes who are blind, to bring prisoners out of prison, to those who sit in darkness out of the prison house. We can be absolutely certain that this refers to the task of the church by comparing only a few passages from the Old Testament, with the New Testament. Luke chapter 1, for example, which is the prophecy that Zechariah gave at the birth of John the Baptist. Luke chapter 1 and verses 78 and 79. Actually, I'm picking it up in the middle of a sentence, but Zechariah said in his prophecy in Luke 1, 78 and 79, through the tender mercy of our God, whereby the day spring from on high hath visited us, to give light to them that sit in darkness and in the shadow of death, to guide our feet in the way of peace. Now, the coming of Jesus was here prophesied to give light to those that sit in darkness and in the shadow of death. Well, this prophecy in Isaiah says to open blind eyes, to bring the prisoners from that prison and them that sit in darkness out of the prison house. It's a reference to this very passage. If you look over at Paul's call when he was converted on the road to Damascus, as he retells it in Acts chapter 26, Acts chapter 26 and verse 18, we have a description of what Jesus said to him on the road to Damascus when he converted him, and basically a description of Paul's missionary commission. Acts 26:18, to open their eyes and to turn them from darkness to light, from the power of Satan unto God, that they may receive forgiveness of sins, inheritance among them which are sanctified by faith that is in me. That is what Paul was to do, to open people's eyes, the Gentiles specifically, in verse 17, delivering thee from the people and from the Gentiles, unto whom, that is, unto the Gentiles, I now send thee. So Paul's calling was to the Gentiles to do what? To open their eyes, to turn them from darkness to light, and from the power of Satan to God. Those three thoughts are taken from Isaiah 42:7. To open the blind eyes, to bring out the prisoners from prison, which is those in bondage to Satan, turn them from the power of Satan to God, and them that sit in darkness to out of the prison house. So, essentially, the language of Isaiah 42:7 and 6 and 7 is used in the New Testament of the church's missionary task. And so I believe that we're reading here about the church age and the gospel being preached in this passage. Verse 8, then, in Isaiah 42, says, I am the Lord, that is my name. My glory will I not give to another, neither my praise to graven images. That is, he won't share the glory for world conquest with graven images. Perhaps what this means is that he will not allow those nations who are loyal to other gods
to idols to prevail against his purpose. He's going to be glorified by his victory, and he's not going to share that victory or relinquish that victory to idols of the other nations. He's going to have his way, despite the resistance of other nations that worship idols. Behold, the former things are come to pass, and new things do I declare. Before they spring forth, I tell you of them. Sing unto the Lord a new song, and his praise from the end of the earth. Ye that go down to the sea and all that is therein, the isles and the inhabitants thereof. Let the wilderness and the cities thereof lift up their voice. The villages that Kedar doth inhabit, let the inhabitants of the rocks sing. Let them shout from the top of the mountains. Let them give glory to the Lord and declare his praise in the islands. This last verse, 12, is quoted by Youth with a Mission on some of their promotional posters of their outreaches to the South Pacific. Let them give glory to the Lord and declare his praise in the islands. And I think it's appropriate. It's a good missionary slogan because that's what it's talking about. It's talking about the people of the praise the Lord from the ends of the earth. Those that go down to the sea, the islands and the inhabitants thereof, the wilderness cities, the wilderness and the cities, inhabitants of the rock, the people at the top of the mountains, and others, people everywhere are going to join their voices together in praising the Lord. Which means, of course, that Gentiles from every part of the world are going to turn from their idols to God. They won't be praising their idols, they'll be singing praises to Jehovah, the Jewish God. And that is accomplished through the efforts of the church and the carrying out of the Great Commission. So, this passage is a remarkable passage in that it tells about Jesus' first coming, then the church age, and then the second coming of Christ in fairly clear terms. At least to my mind, they're fairly clear. Now, meanwhile, back at the farm, what's happening with Israel? Verse 19. After we get this scenario of the first and second coming of Christ and the work of the church in between, we need to deal with what's natural Israel, what's their role in all of this? Now, of course, the